Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are hurtling through the airwaves with the brilliant assistance of OldFootballShirts.com. Well, the international break gave most of our players the weekend off, but for some, World Cup qualification was at stake. For Davy Prepper, it was always going to be a big ask, but he did at least add to his tally of international goals. For Matty Ryan and Shane Duffy, however, the playoffs beckon to see if they will take their places in Russia. This weekend, we face an Everton side for the first time since the 9th of April 1983, in a game that Everton fans will have to make the 274-mile journey at stupid o'clock in the morning because the game is being shown on television. In India. Not UK. India. Just let that one hang. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we're delighted to welcome back a man who, over the last 20 years, has seen many challenges and has been so good at them, the club keep giving him a load more. It's the man who's never allowed to retire. Welcome back, Martin Perry. Hello, Martin. How are you?
I'm very well. Great to be back.
Oh, good to see you. I always fear that come the day that Martin goes, you won't get a death certificate. It'll just go 6 feet under with an S106.
It's Ravens in the Tower, Martin, isn't it?
It is. Whatever happens, you know. But anyway, so 20 years behind the bell. Do you remember your first day?
I do remember my first day because, of course, you'll recall we took over, effectively, took control, the night before the last game at the Goldstone. Who's going to forget that? We turned up at Brighton the following morning. We didn't even know where the director's door was in the Goldstone.
Someone has smashed it off, I think.
Actually, I've got a quote here, actually.
Go on.
It's from someone called Martin Perry, actually. It was the last time I saw the Goldstone. And my first day acting as director.
Yeah, we were taken on a stadium tour. It wasn't very impressive, I have to tell you.
It was pretty similar to the hard hat tours we used to do at Felmer.
Oh yeah, not quite the same. but of course, at that point, although we'd effectively got control of the club, we weren't actually directors. It took us another four or five months to negotiate the share purchase agreement. So we actually didn't become formally directors until, I think it's the 4th of September 1997. So,
do you remember how it was you got involved in the first place?
Yeah, it was a phone call from Ivor Kaplan who...
You've killed all my notes here. I've got a quote on this.
give us the next quote.
He says... Ivor Kaplan, who was at the time the leader of Hove Council, knew the leader of Kirklees Council, John Harmon, and John put him in touch with us. Ivor asked for him to come down to Brighton to talk about what we had achieved at Huddersfield and have a chat about the problems Brighton were facing. There you go.
Yeah. I'd much rather have heard that from Martin, you know.
Yeah. Well, you told Ivor that.
There is another quote, which I said, Ivor, I would love to come down to Brighton. I'm a Brighton fan. I was brought up in Brighton. Brighton's my club, but I don't want to end up running a football club. 3 years later, I was running the football club.
Be careful what you don't wish for.
Okay.
So obviously Ivor was, I'm just trying to think, he was still a councillor at the time.
He was leader of Hove Council at the time when all this started. Of course, then Brighton and Hove Councils merged to become Brighton and Hove. I think it was
just Brighton Hove
Borough Council or whatever it was. And then, of course, they became a unitary authority and then they got city status. But that time, when Ivor started this off, he was still... leader of Hove, and then of course he became Hove MP, and Steve Basson was became leader of Brighton Council.
So, what were you initially asked to do? Was it more of an advisory role in the background to say, look, this is how you get a ground built kind of thing?
Well, my first meeting actually was in the front room of Liam Brady's house in Shirley Drive when I was introduced to Dick and Bob Pinnock. And we talked about what we'd done at Huddersfield, and Dick recognised at that stage that he got no experience in terms of planning or construction or, you know, how to put a stadium together. So we agreed at that point that actually we were a good a good match and that we could work together. And in fact, having the McAlpine name at that stage behind Dick, I think, gave the whole consortium at that stage credibility.
And so
I think
an air of gravitas to a certain degree.
Absolutely, because fans knew what had been achieved up at Huddersfield. And so they thought, they began then to realise that, you know, Dick was serious. Mm. And that not only did he have, obviously, a huge knowledge of the club itself, but now he'd got somebody on board that actually could deliver a stadium. And I think it was that combination, really, that gave the consortium its momentum.
Actually, we're going to come back and talk about this a little bit later on, but I don't think we've ever actually asked you, can you remember what your first ever game was as an Albion fan?
I can't remember the game, but I remember one player in particular. It was a really obscure player called Mike Tiddy.
Oh, yeah?
That name's come up quite a lot at the moment.
Not that obscure, because he either holds an appearance or goal-scoring record within the second division when we were first ever in the second division in the late 50s, early 60s. But, yes, his, I think probably people of a given age would actually remember, yeah, Mike. Do you remember it because it's a silly name?
No, not at all. He came to my school.
Oh.
And, I mean, it's the same thing. It's you know, a lot of what AITC is based on is the fact that, you know, when you see a player and that player talks to you about even subjects like maths or reading or whatever it is, you engage, you go, you're interested, you listen. And I was hooked from that moment on.
I remember I had that when I was you may or may not know this about me, Adrian, but I was in the Boys Brigade once upon a time. The 14th Brighton Boys Brigade at the Florence Road Baptist Church.
I've got a really horrible image in my head right now, but yeah,
no.
Involves shorts, but
we didn't wear shorts. No, we had to wear long trousers and a blue jumper. And
did you play the bugle?
No, I was on the snare drum. I was on the side drum. But that was later. No, we had a visit from a couple of Albion players. I mean, in the same way that Mike Tiddy visited Martin when he was at Martin's school when he was there, we had two Brighton players come by. Just the more small matter of Mark Lawrence and Brian Horton. Mm-hmm. You know, a couple of chaps in their early 20s who, you know, thought they'd sort of swan by and just give a talk about football generally.
No, I mean, we had at our school in Burgess Hill, we had Graham Mosley and Peter Wall come along.
Was Mosley potty then?
Oh, God, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And, and then when in the FA Cup final, where Gary Stevens and Neil Smiley came along with the record to sign and everything, the past was another country.
The point being made here is that it still happens. I mean, let's say, tied in with the Albion community, which Martin's the head of, is that, you know, that was a kind of a forerunner of those days. Now it's almost, I guess, almost written into the contract, isn't it? That you go out there to the schools and the...
Well, the players have in their contract that they spend time, you know, in the community. In fact, Dale Stevens this afternoon was at a session, which was fantastic. So, you know, the players do that. And Liam Rossinia is one of the AITC or club ambassadors. Mm. And we've now got Laura Rafferty from the girls' team is also an ambassador. So... their involvement is fantastic and it's so helpful.
Okay. Well, we are going to come and talk about your 20-year journey with the club a little bit later on. But first, we have got to talk about the main issue that faces you at the moment. Because, I mean, you've had all sorts of planning issues for your time, obviously getting the stadium built, getting to Falmer, saving the club, etc., etc.
A small matter. Last time we were on, you said, oh, we've just had our 50th planning application since I joined. Do you know what you're on now?
64.
So,
and my score, by the way, is 63-1.
Yes. We'll talk about that one in a bit.
But okay, but it's New Monk's Farm. For those of you who've been living on the moon, what is New Monk's Farm?
New Monk's Farm is a parcel of land that is adjacent to our training ground. Those of you who know where the training ground is, there is a plot of land that surrounds it that had planning permission for a golf course, so-called, but was really a landfill site. But it's been allocated in the Ada local plan for housing and for employment use. And that's why we took an interest in it, because what goes on there impacts on the training ground. We've invested $32 million in that facility, which is reckoned and rated as one of the best in the country. And we wanted to make sure that whatever goes on that site is done properly. It's in a floodplain, and therefore there has to be a drainage strategy to deal with the groundwater. And if that is not done properly, but more importantly, once it's built, if it's not maintained properly, then there could be problems, and which would impact on us.
Mm. So, I mean, that is one of the questions that's come up. It's like, why are the club involved in this?
So, mainly the reason why we got involved was because of the allocation of the local plan. We were really concerned that what went on that site protected our main asset, which is the training ground. Mm. And we have the skills to develop it. And once it's built, we've also got the team that we need to be able to maintain it. So it's in our interest, but because we are local, because we are there, we own the freehold of the training grounds, and we're there forever. Mm. We have that interest. It is shared actually with the residents because. If we make sure it's done properly, we will not only be protecting ourselves, we'll be protecting them.
Who owns the land in question that you're talking about developing here? Who owns that?
We do. We bought it.
Right.
Once we knew it was going to be developed, we purchased it. So we own.
So when you say we, we're talking about a subsidiary
so
of Breidenhove.
We have a special purpose subsidiary called New Monk's Farm Development Limited. It is a wholly owned subsidiary of Brighton and Hove Albion Holdings Limited. And so all the money that goes into it, but all the money that comes out of it gets ploughed back into the club.
Right,
into
into the club.
So, I mean, obviously we're going to come and touch about the IKEA thing. So anything in regards to you have a profit share with them or something? Or
no, we don't have a profit share at all. What we've done is entered into a conditional contract with them, which means that when we get planning permission, we will sell them a parcel of land, which they will then build their unit on.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now there are quite a lot of issues that with building the stadium, there was also very very a lot of issues in regards to that. But you had 100% support from the Albion fan base because we wanted this thing built. It was important for the club's future, etc., etc. With this, I would say you probably haven't got as much support as you would like.
Well, that's certainly true, and we'd like to get the message out to reassure fans, because first of all, as I said earlier, it's very much a club development, and therefore any benefits that arise out of it benefit the club. But secondly, I think there are, if you like, there are three main issues. The first one is transport. What's the impact going to be on the A27, particularly with an IKEA? The second one is flood risk, and how's that being dealt with? And the third one is really what is in it for the local community. So if I take each of those in turn, first of all, transport. We've had, as we did at the stadium, a transport consultant do a great deal of work on it. Now, at the stadium, that company was a company which now called Vectos. We used the same company. At the stadium, they got the traffic projections to within 1% of what's actually happened. We've been monitoring it continuously ever since we opened for 6 years now, nearly into the seventh year. And what they predicted would happen, both in time, in the number of people that would use the train, number of people that use the bus or the car or come by bike or whatever it is, they got to within 1%. So their modelling is very, very accurate. Mm-hmm. It happens.
Isn't it something like 30 cars an hour was projected?
Well, I'll come on to that. It happens that Vectos also work for IKEA up and down the country.
All right.
So what they've got is all the data from the stores, not only where they've submitted a planning application, but actually what's happening once that store is open. So how people shop, the shopping patterns, they've got that data, which they can plug into our model. So we're very confident with the numbers that they've produced. Now, what they've done is they've come up with a series of projections. First of all, 74% of people coming to that IKEA will approach it from the east. And the reason for that, of course, is that you've obviously got a large catchment to the east in Brighton. Mm. But anyone coming from the north will come down either the A23 or down the A24 and round behind Stenning and Bramber and Upper Beeding and through the junction with the 283 and then approach the store from the eastern side, not the western side. Mm-hmm. And the eastern side of the A27 does not get anywhere near as congested as the section that's between Grinstead Lane, Lions Farm through to the Grove Lodge roundabout. 24.
Sorry, for people who don't necessarily realise, they were talking about basically from Shoreham Airport west to kind of the back of Worthing.
Yeah,
aren't we talking
that's
about?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
That's right.
So we're talking about a five mile stretch.
That's the congested section.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And around Sussex Pad as well.
Only
who's driven that, I think, knows how congested it is.
Only 24% of people coming to IKEA will actually come from that direction. Those are two very important statistics. It means the bulk of the traffic will not come through the congested section. Yeah. And Highways England and have appointed independent consultants who've gone through all of these catchments, all of this trip generation, and they have written to us now and confirmed we've got it right.
Okay.
So that's the first point. The second point is that this site was allocated and has been allocated in the local plan for something like 4 years. What's been going on in that four-year period is that the council have been consulting with Highways England, with West Sussex County Council, and they've looked at what the impact would be of 600 houses and employment space on that site. And at a public inquiry, an examination in public, which took place in January this year, they produced a statement of common ground which said that the road network can carry the additional trips being generated by that development. So they were happy that the network could carry it. What we did, of course, was to plonk an IKEA on there. That wasn't expected. But if you compare an IKEA with that local plan allocation, actually in the morning, the traffic is less. And the reason for that is, of course, people do not shop at IKEA between 7 and 9 in the morning because it's not open.
You haven't met my ex.
Well, she'll have difficulty getting in when the shop's not open.
Well,
you know, if it was an office development or a warehouse development, people would be arriving at work between 7 and 9. Mm. They're not arriving at an IKEA. So that in the morning AM peak, which is where there are the peak flows on the A27, the traffic we generate is less.
Mm.
In the evening, the increase is actually because people link the trips, they drop in as they're going past. Actually, the increase is less than 1%, which when you take 24% of the number actually means that on the western side, that congested section, that equates to 30 vehicles an hour, which is one every 2 minutes, which you would not notice.
Now also in that plan, though, Martin, there is also a plan to remove the traffic lights. I think it's Sussex Pad, isn't it? And put a roundabout in there.
So Highways England, as part of this whole strategy around this local plan and what's going on, are desperate to close the Sussex Pad junction and close the junction from...
So this is before the development?
So this is... Well, they want to get rid of those traffic lights.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is, of course, they are in a 70-mile-an-hour section of the A27. And there are a number of shunt-type accidents. And they want to reduce the conflicts. Because by reducing the conflicts, you then improve the traffic flows. So their proposal always has been to put in one single junction which serves the airport and New Monks Farm, and that's why that junction has been closed.
Okay.
So does this? So is it specifically a roundabout that's proposed, or is there a kind of a flyover that's?
No, it's a three arm roundabout. So the two arms on the A27 right. and an arm coming in from New Monks Farm sure. and the airport.
Mm. Okay.
But the capacity, what we've been able to do, the capacity on that roundabout is far far greater than those traffic lights. And what we've looked at is, you know, traffic growth through to 2027. And by 2027, those traffic lights, that junction will be an absolute nightmare. Whereas with a roundabout, there is much greater capacity and can cope with that with that traffic growth.
Unless okay, so it's that's a roundabout in Swindon.
Okay,
perhaps.
So that's transport dealt with. That's one out of the three. Part two was?
Flood risk.
Go for it.
So flood risk, the site, what happens is you've got the South Downs, apologies for that one. You have the South
Guildford,
Downs,
mate,
you have Lancing Hill to the north of the site, and groundwater comes down from there, and there is a spring line along the line of the northern boundary, along the line of the A27.
Hmm.
And then it disperses across a series of ditches across the site. But it makes its way through to two outfalls, one on the River Ada, and which is by the airport, and one by the Dogs Trust over on the 259. But both of those outfalls are tide-locked for 6 hours every tide cycle. So when you get high tide, the tide flaps shut, and the water cannot escape. So what happens is the water levels rise within the site.
Hmm.
What we've got and what we're proposing is to build a pumping station on the bank of the River Ada over by the airport, which means that we will pump the water over the top of the new tidal wall that's being built there, which means that we can discharge the water for 24 hours a day, so we don't get this build-up.
Hmm.
And it means that we have considerably increased the capacity to be able to cope with the groundwater that arises. And in fact, our concern actually is that we could overpump and we could run the ditches dry. And of course, you need them wet to maintain the ecology. So actually, we are the calculations quite clearly show, and we've got something like 132 monitoring stations currently on that site. So we know what the water levels are doing. And so we know that the pumping station will cope with those flows, and we've got capacity to cope with the very worst storm event that we could possibly envisage over the next 100 years.
Mm. I mean, it has been prone to flooding there previously anyway, so by doing this, this could actually alleviate that problem as well.
It will, and also we importantly, it will improve the hydraulic conditions in the existing Manor Close, Manor Way area,
okay.
which floods, because what we're doing is improving the conditions downstream so the water can escape.
Sure. So that's part two done. And part three?
Part three were the benefits to the Lancing and Ada and the local community. And in summary, 1,300 jobs. 182 million pounds worth of investment in the area, 3.5 million pounds per annum into the local council to replace central government funding that they've lost. A 28 hectare country park, the largest country park that's been created in Ada for the last 85 years. 23 million into the local economy, and importantly, because we are improving the access into the airport and enabling further development on the airport, we're securing the future of Shoreham Airport.
Sure. So what's going?
You didn't mention the school either.
I was about to say, as well as housing in there. I mean, there's obviously sort of an infrastructure, because this is effectively a kind of its own little mini village, isn't it? I mean, its own sort of development. So what else apart from housing?
It is. So we've got land allocated for a primary school, and also we've got a network of cycle routes so that we can improve the access through into the South Downs National Park. There's been some confusion over that, but in actual fact, there are two routes into the national park, one at the roundabout, but one under the river or under the A27 at the River Ada to get through into the South Downs National Park. And also provision for a health centre, surgery,
so it's only effectively its own community is being built there. All the facilities for its own sort of almost self-contained, if necessary, community to be built there.
It is self-contained. However, it does link to the community. It links through to Lancing, to the Mashburn Estate. It links through to Lancing. We're running buses from Lancing Station. And the stagecoach services, which will link through to Shoreham.
Okay, how much of this of the housing stock is affordable? Considered affordable housing?
It's 30%, and we are not. We all of our figures are based on 30%. So we're not going to be trying to negotiate that down, as many developers do. So that means 180 units. will be affordable units, and the larger proportion of those will be what we call social rented. But so that they're the means tested ones. They're the ones that serve the housing waiting lists on ADA's lists.
Okay, so what's the next step? What can we do to help?
So the ADA local plan is being adopted in December. The planning application is in. It will probably go to committee early next year. We would love if Albion supporters felt able to support this because of the benefits both to the club and to the local community. We would love them to write in and go to the website log on and register their support.
Is any sort of greater weight attached to those who live within the Worthing or Ada District Council areas?
Well, I think where the most weight is, yes, if they live in that area, that helps. But it's about really, why do you support it? Do you support the fact that it's creating employment? Do you support the fact that it's actually going to improve the drainage in that whole area? It's those. Do you regard the Shoreham Airport as a community asset that you want to see retained because it's vital for the future of Shoreham Airport? If you come up with those kinds of reasons, those are the reasons that will really count.
How have the locals taken to this the ideas?
It's mixed, and to be very truthful, Lancing Parish Council are opposed to it. But they are opposed to development on that site. And the point is, of course, that particular horse has bolted. The site's been allocated for the last 4 years. Mm. So development is going to take place on that site.
It's just a case of what?
And it's a case of what?
Which is very, very similar to what the Amex was, really, wasn't it?
It's a number of the same arguments, yeah. But we know of a number of people within the Lancing area that support it. The local business community supports it because they understand the benefits to the area. Residents are bound to be concerned, and I understand those fears. But what I've tried to do, and I've attended 3 public meetings now, which
you've come up with your ears burning,
wasn't an easy process. But I hope that they, by going to those meetings and being willing to stand up in front of them, that they appreciated the fact that we actually do believe that this. Will deliver real tangible benefits to the area.
So do you have the support of the planning authority itself?
We certainly have the support of the local authority, okay. ADA.
Okay. And for those who have got major worries still, is there anywhere they can go to read up this information to appease their minds?
Well, if people really are concerned, I've answered a lot of emails about it, and I am quite prepared. If people were to email me and say, look, I'm concerned about this, I've had the cycling lobby write to me, and I've responded to it, and I'm happy to respond because it's important that we get the facts out there which are correct.
Okay, let's move along from there. You are listening to The Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are brought to you in association with IldFootballShirts.com. And
Phil,
as usual,
he's in Scotland, he's been looking at bridges all week, hasn't he?
This is possibly a bridge too far for me.
Is it?
Okay. You know what? This shirt, absolutely gorgeous, I think, but it's old. Okay. And it's a football shirt, so that's a. I'm going to pass that to Martin. If
Martin,
you can just
describe that one
for me.
Well, it's a. It was a dark. Is it dark blue?
It is dark blue.
With a pinstripe.
Look like drainage ditches, mate.
No. It's traffic flows, and they're flowing freely.
They are.
it's sort of a wide pinstripe with a round door with an A on it.
Has he photoshopped out the
badge here? You'll never get it out, so I'm not.
Okay, the team is IF. He always goes for these Finnish ones because he loves tripping you up on these words or anything like that. So I'm going to say that it's a Greek team.
You're wrong.
Go on.
Okay, here we go. Put my teeth back in.
I'm going to guess the year. I'm going to say 84, 85.
He hasn't actually given me a year on this
Phil,
one, actually.
You're sacked.
But here is your shirt of the week, says Phil, chosen with your guest in mind.
Oh, go on.
A bit.
What's
this?
I told you it was traffic flows.
Yeah, this is the home shirt of Swedish lower league side Hults Idrottsnörning, more commonly known as AIF.
I'd rather he gave you a Finnish team, because at least...
Hang on.
You're doing Swedish.
Swedish, Finnish, it's all the same to me, to be honest. But it's like
they're not the same languages, mate, believe me.
I know, but yeah, there's more umlauts than you can shake a stick at, so I'm good at umlauts these days.
Yeah. How many eggs do you use in them?
Boom tish. It's Armhult Idrottsförening, more commonly known as simply as AIF. They play at the Almedalen Stadium in the town of Armhult in Kronoberg County in southern Sweden. ARF are a perpetual member of the lower Sydöstra Götaland leagues, which is the fifth level of football in Sweden. Armhult is a town rather better known as the birthplace of IKEA.
Oh, well, I wondered what the connection was.
Yeah. IKEA is the name IKEA comes from the...
It's an acronym.
Acronym of the...
That includes the initials of IKEA's founder,
and
Ingvar Kamprad, Elmtalid, the name of the farm where he grew up, and Agunyard, the town where he is from.
We'll be asking questions later, Martin.
Yeah. The first IKEA store opened in 1943 when Ingvar was just 17 years old. There you go. Thanks for that, Phil.
He was able to open in 43 because Sweden was officially neutral during the Second World War. So.
Okay, just before we move on quickly, we just got one item on our notice board today, and we have gone continental, Alan.
Continental?
We have gone continental. There is, some of you may have noticed this already, in your Albion Raw inboxes on your pod.
Sorry, I thought you meant European. I'm thinking, we haven't gone European, mate. We've gone Australasian. Yes, our good friend Richard Parker, who started up the Albion Raw back in 2003 with his friend Johnny Harmon on what was then Festival Radio here. Well, Richard now lives in Auckland and has teamed up with Steve Longley from Seagulls Down Under. And they've decided to launch their own podcast, tagging onto ours. It's fair enough, absolutely. Got no issue with that, because, like I say, Richard did start it all going. And they recorded their first show this week. It was kind of interesting. You've got Richard in Auckland. You've got Steve in Sydney, which I believe the distance is about the same as Brighton to Rome. And an Everton fan who also lives in Auckland, so they were previewing the game there. But if you get a chance to listen to that, it's on the. We've uploaded it to the same place where the Albion Roar is loaded to. That's on Audio Boom these days, not so much iTunes. You can still get us on iTunes, but we're on Audio Boom these days. So have a listen to that. It's good fun, and it's you'll get a pretty good idea as to. You know what it's like to support the Albion from so far away. If you're local, you're not necessarily going to get that idea. If you're in Australia, New Zealand, America, and we've got people in the Far East, we know we've got a lot of listeners in America. Then you know they'll know what it's like to be an expat listening to, you know, or hearing or supporting about the show, about the team. So, if you get a chance, do listen in. It's a good hoot. And what they're also suggesting is that Steve's saying that if anyone's going over to Australia for the Ashes this winter, do hook up with them. He's sorting something out, but I can't remember what it is, so you'll have to get a hold of him. But just to remind him that remind you all that on the 28th of October, for anyone that is in Sydney, is the Robert Eaton Memorial Fund annual challenge match down under at Kings Park School in Sydney. The Albion have a perfect 4-0 record over there, but if you feel like being in the area and attending, they'll be more than welcome.
I feel like being in the area.
We feel like, all right, if you are in the area, yes. Just the 12,000 miles away.
Well,
yeah.
You know, that's almost as far as it is from Everton to Brighton on a Sunday morning.
Welcome on board the Albion Royal Down Under.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, well, let's just quickly talk about the game this Sunday. It's been designated as an Albion in the Community Day.
Albion in the Community Takeover Day. So what we are hoping and what we would love is for supporters to donate. There will be bucket collections outside the stadium, both before the game and after the game. If every home supporter were to donate just £1, we would raise £27,000. And, of course, it does happen to coincide with the fact that the round pound is no longer official currency. So it would be really sound if you brought your round pound
to the ground.
We are bound to do that.
But that's sound advice.
But AITC is strongly supported by the club. Tony and the club are fantastically generous to the charity. We get support from our major sponsors and supporters. I mean, American Express, for example, fund a number of the programs through their program called Realize the Potential. And some of the programs are funded. But we do have a funding gap. Last year, our fundraisers were targeted to raise over £500,000, and they managed it. This year, we've set them the target of raising £750,000 to help fund the work of AITC. So, I think that Albion supporters are very proud of what we do and what we achieve. And if they can feel able to put some of their loose change in those buckets tomorrow, that would be absolutely fantastic.
Absolutely. I'd imagine those that carry in the buckets would prefer, I was about to say paper, but it's kind of plastic, the pig's bladder plastic or something these days, isn't it? But
well, if you remember at the Theatre Royal event that Peter Brackley ran, we did say that actually our buckets unfortunately don't take coins. Because this is special and the round pound, we'd love coins. We'd love notes. But as I say, last year we raised over £15,000 on the day. That was match funded, and so we had £30,000 to buy a new minibus, which was used by the disabled teams. But on those days when match day or match away days, when it's not being used, we can use it to transport disabled supporters to away matches. So we don't particularly want a minibus this year, but it costs us £5,000 a year to run a disability programme. Any support that fans can give is really, really appreciated, and does a huge amount to help the supporters who are and players who are disadvantaged, who want to be able to play football.
I mean, we've seen so many success stories come through it. I mean, Matt Francis being a classic example, going on to play for England in the World Cup final in the power chair team. To the get back to work.
So you've got Danny Hemsley, who plays for England, who's one of our amputee players. But there are the elite teams, but there are also the teams that do it for the fun of doing it, and that's important. There's about 250 participants take part in these disability programs. But of course, our work isn't just around disability. We work in health, we work in schools, we work in inclusion. There are all these various activities, as well as the after-school coaching and football pathway.
What is it the Cheyenne retiring Guy Butters and Danny Cullett work in then? I'm looking through.
They help in our BTEC program, which is a program to achieve a qualification in sport or sport management. There's football coaching, and then there's academic teaching.
Guy Butters,
in the afternoons. They assist with those programs, and I mean, they've been transformational for some people. People come in with relatively few qualifications, get their BTEC, and we've seen them go to university.
Life-changing.
Which, as I say, it's transformational, it's life-changing. It creates opportunity, which is what we're about.
I mean, there's been so much change within Albion community from when it first started up to where it is now, and it is absolutely fantastic. So anything you can do to support it, obviously we're going to be talking about that in more detail in the next few weeks. It's Matt Dawn who's in charge of it now, isn't it?
Matt Dawn's in charge. I'd like to think the aforementioned Butters and Cullip would actually turn up, and because it's a long-standing joke we've got with Danny Cullip. He genuinely is a shy person when it comes to doing. He just gets on with it. I think Martin will back me up on this. He's a fine ambassador for Albion in the community. A far cry from the psychotic nutcase screaming fellow who could actually ball down the trees with Dean with Let's Have a Winner. And he's always said, I want my work to do the talking. And I said, well, we don't actually know what you do, so come in and do the talking. So we will get Danny Cullip in one day.
I can assure you his work does do the talking. The two of them, I mean, they go around together a lot. But they do a fantastic job, and they're always smiling.
I'd be terrified if they came at me smiling. To be honest,
they really enjoy it. But and we love having them around. But the teams have been really successful. The BTEC teams have been really successful.
Sure.
But importantly, these participants have achieved some tremendous grades and gone on to greater things.
Mm. And what's more, you can read all about it when you go to the match on Sunday. Mm-hmm.
So just remember, we'll give you some sound advice. Bring a round pound to the ground.
And you will also get, as you leave, a glossy brochure giving you a summary of the work of AITC. And in advance, thank you all for your fantastic support.
Okay. Well, let's move it on now, because, Martin, 20 years ago, actually just before you came on air, you gave us a little tidbit of information that you are now currently the longest-serving Albion director since the war.
According to Tim Carter... when we celebrated I celebrated 20 years as a director, I became the longest continuously serving director since the war. Ray Bloom, in aggregate, has served much longer, but there was a break in the period when initially when Dick, Bob Pinnock, and I took over. Apparently
Does it feel like 20 years?
It's gone incredibly quickly. I mean, it's been wonderful. I absolutely loved every minute of it.
I mean, when you came aboard 20 years ago, did you ever think you'd ever see us in the Premier League?
I have to say, no.
Really?
I mean, bear in mind that my first real experiences of running the club were Gillingham, and the football there was fairly dire. And I can remember some of those games. I think it was a night game against Plymouth when I just thought, oh, my God.
But drunken Attila in the PA box.
But somehow or other, I mean, I always knew that this club was capable of much, much more. But even getting into what is now the Championship, but then Division One, felt like a mile away. I think in those years, I think I'm right in saying Manchester City won the Division One title and promotion to the Premier League. And I can remember seeing the images of them, you know, holding the trophy and thinking, you know, would we ever get there? Well, we got so close to it, didn't we, last season? So it's been an amazing journey. Yeah. It's a wonderful story. I ought to write a book about it.
Mostly upwardly. But you've just said earlier, and we've got to sort of have a quick natter about this one. You said that your record in planning is. Played 64, won 63, lost one. Goals for, yeah. We us being the pessimistic, miserable little so and so's that we are, we have to talk about that L1. Is there a replay gonna happening, bumping down the pipeline?
The issue when we lost the planning, and you remember the story that of course we fought for 10 years because Lewis didn't want to be able to see the stadium. And then Brighton turned down the hotel because it blocked the view of the stadium from Lewis, which I still haven't quite got over.
The parishioners in favour of it, weren't they?
The parishioners had no problem with it whatsoever. And in fact, we know that Lewis Council didn't have any problems with it either.
Was it political point scoring, do you think?
I won't go. I mean, you know, it just makes me cross to think about it.
Really. So you're going to get back in the ring.
Well, what happened was that we, if you remember, it had a radiotherapy centre underneath it.
Yeah.
And because we didn't get planning permission, we lost the funding. And we've been looking ever since to see what else we could put underneath. We've had some interest, but at the moment we've got a lot on our plate. I mean, just through the summer, as you know, we did an enormous amount of work to the stadium to get ready for the Premier League. We've got New Monks Farm running. So we are monitoring the situation and it's still there, but it's, for the moment it's parked.
Can I watch this space?
No. OK, but I mean, you've had, obviously during the time you've had a lot of highlights. So what is the one thing that's stuck in your mind over that like last 20 years?
Well, as you say, I mean, there are so many highlights, aren't there? But I mean, I have to say now... the Wigan game this season. I mean, how
if you remember it, you weren't
earth
there.
Are we ever going to forget it? the way the afternoon unfolded.
Give us a story from inside
fantastic.
The director's box, because we know the story from the fans. We were with Cowdy when we were standing next to Cowdy when Derby equalised and what have you. So give us the view well, from inside the director's box.
Well, we came in after after the final whistle. We came in. I mean, we knew at that stage that we were there. On goal
barring
difference,
the bent result from Huddersfield.
Barring, you know, I mean, yeah. I think I forget how many goals Huddersfield
30,
had to score, but it was, you know, we just knew we were there, but it still wasn't up on the screen. Brighton promoted, and obviously we then watched the Huddersfield, the Derby game. So when Derby equalised. As did the rest of the stadium, the boardroom erupted.
Did you throw beer around like they did in the North Stand?
Well, we didn't throw beer around in the boardroom because you don't do that sort of thing in a boardroom.
No, champagne.
Champagne. Yeah. I think there was champagne actually. but I remember first of all, of course, we'd had this wonderful pitch invasion, which was supposed not to happen.
Unlucky Paul Barber. Too bad.
That didn't work. and we were in the boardroom, and of course then there was another pitch invasion. So of course it was, oh my God, there's another pitch invasion. And so we went outside and just enjoyed the atmosphere. I remember Chris coming out into the tunnel and waving. Chris then came up to the boardroom to see us. But it was just the sheer joy in seeing on the screen, you know, Brighton promoted. it was tremendous.
Do you wish that you could have had you could have had the opportunity to have been crowd surfing across the train like Ollie Norwood was? And
well, it was fabulous. I mean, I think I might have done it if I'd been on the train. I just think it was fantastic that the players went down to the to the centre of Brighton.
Went down to the station to get drunk, basically.
And the next thing we get is sort of images of them crowd surfing, and we're thinking, my God, they've still got three games to play. But I thought it was fabulous that they did that. You know, I think because that just demonstrated for me the togetherness between the players and the fans. We were celebrating together.
Yeah.
No, I mean, people do say that there isn't the connect with the players these days.
You don't want that aloofness from the players. You want them to be part. You know, everyone has. I mean, the point is, and this is what we're talking about just before we came on air, and you're talking about, of all the things that's been busy during the summer, is the amount of media interest. Mm. We've had it, but Martin's had it. I mean, the various things that have happened. But the point is that for so many people, for the media interest, the interest is not about the promotion per se. It's about the 20-year journey, and which all three of us in this room were on, and thousands out there who, well, our listener and thousands of his friends, you know, were on too. And I think that the whole culture of the club has actually been able to grow to a large extent, quite organically, without actually all these... You know, yes, there could be these hard. Oh my God, don't ruin the players, don't injure them. Everyone knows, you know, what an asset they are to them, and so there is this kind of mutual respect. Yeah, the players. I can imagine that probably more players and more clubs when they get promotion want to go diving right into the middle of their fans and just say, yeah, let's have some fun here.
Now, Martin, you've had many roles with the club during your time here, and that will have constantly changed. And obviously, you're more involved in the planning issues and trying to get things built these days.
I currently have five.
Yeah, but I mean, how much?
Just the five.
How much do you actually have to do with the footballing side of things these days?
Not a huge amount. Mm. I mean,
do you miss that?
No, I don't miss it. Because, I mean, Paul Barber in particular is very good at keeping all of the directors informed as to what is going on. But for security reasons... It's particularly through the transfer window, we allow them to get on with it. There is a team, they know what they're doing, and we just we don't interfere, because it's such a complex process it's best that they quietly work away at it and we keep it as quiet as we possibly can.
Now, we're talking about the fact that, so, you know, obviously we've been involved for 20 years, and in those 20 years you've come to meet a lot of people, especially a lot of fans, those who are on the Falmouth for All committee, and sadly one by one, well, we've sadly lost two this year. We've had to pay our last respects to Paul Welsh and to Ed Basford, and there are many people on the Falmouth for All team, you know, who we know that they've done a fabulous job. Talk about the people that you've met, especially the Falmouth for All team, and I don't think we've actually had you sort of talk about Paul or Ed or any of those that we've lost on the way. So, you know, give us your thoughts as to, you know, those people you've met on the journey.
There were a whole range of characters. I mean, when we first got involved, obviously the first campaign was Bring Home the Albion from Gillingham back to Withdean, and there were key characters in there that worked so hard on that particular campaign, and also getting Withdean. If you remember, Withdean wasn't a straightforward planning application, and then we went into and of course that had followed up actually the campaign to get control of the club. So that's when I first began to meet, you know, these various characters, larger than life characters, you know, John
Well, they had Bain to be, didn't they?
They had to be, and they were tremendous. You know, I still remember the sitting at the Concord with David Davis and those meetings, those public meetings. I mean, that, you know, there are times like that, memories like that will indelibly etched on my memory. then, of course, then we got into the Found for All campaign, and it was a team, just as the team on the pitch. And so, Paul Samra led those meetings extremely ably. I always remember we'd have a meeting in the evening, and by sort of midnight, the minutes were out. It was astonishing, really. But you've got Ed with his particular take on issues, supported by Ros South, and his political and transport connections, which were so valuable. You had Tim Carter with his detail. You had Paul Welsh, who actually sort of analysed situations, probably as in his background. That was his nature. And Sarah, and obviously Liz Costa, and you had the humour of John Cowan, and then there was Bill Swallow and Jan Swallow. They were characters in their own right. They had their own personalities, and they all contributed to these meetings.
Without them, where do you think the club would be?
Oh, well, I mean, probably still at Gillingham. I mean, it was the combination of fans plus board pulling together the team, pulling together in one direction that actually led to the success. There's no doubt about that. Dick saved the club. We then all pulled together with our various skills to achieve what we've achieved. When you look back now at what we've achieved, it is astonishing.
We did it. I mean, it was the club, it was the fans. Like I say, I had to have everyone pull together.
There is, of course, one other person that I need to talk about, and of course that's Tony. When Tony came in and then took over, he took on the mantle. We'd got the potential then at that point. We'd got planning permission, but it the reason we are where we are is because of Tony. We can never ever underestimate just how much he's done for this football club. It's just extraordinary, and the board grew through that time. So the board team grew. I mean, it's now 11 members on the board.
And there's only three of us in this room, and it's time for us all to go, unfortunately. So I've just got to say thank you, as always, to Martin Perry. You're always welcome here any time. And keep
we'll
an
find
eye...
a nicer studio for you next time.
Lovely, lovely to be here. And, great to be back.
And keep an eye out on what's going on down there in Lancing, and hopefully we can get something built. And thanks to Alan Wares. I've been Aidy Pack, and we'll see you again next week. Thanks a lot. Bye.
I'd like a one-way ticket home, ticket home. I can watch my television, talk on the telephone. In every town I wander, there's a billboard on a throne. Ticket home, I want a ticket home. Ticket home, I want a ticket home. Does anybody know my name or recognize my face? I must have from somewhere, but I can't recall the place. They dropped me at the matinee, they left without a trace. Ticket home.